This is the Moonifest Destiny podcast. Moonifest Destiny is a novel I wrote in 1991. The subtitle is The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please go back and start with Chapter 1. Moonifest Destiny by Peter Gelman is available on Kindle for 99 cents. I will now read Chapter 26. The Fourth Day of Siege. The Hospitalleteers of St. Sam. The red-hot iron ball of dawn rose and burst. Once again, the 12-pound shells flung in on us, hissing, flashing, cracking. Down in the dark and dirty bomb-proof, little was said about this surprise resumption of bombardment. We were disappointed and weary. During the cold and quiet night, the Army of the Sea of Tranquility had floated most of their remaining cannon across the cold sea and fortified them close in on us. Then, just before dawn, their cannonade began afresh, worser than before. They set big wicker baskets all around their cannon, packed hard with sand. The six-pounders of Captain Miles and Captain Sewell snapped and popped and rolled a few little balls against those baskets, where they burst electric fire and half-split them. But until we cotton balers could drag Captain Loud's big lightning guns and their galvanic caissons across the yard to the east side of the fort, General Lunarista had us lassoed tight around the neck. 7th Infantry Infirmary, Fort Texas. Mr. Judah Payne, Chief Surgeon. Mr. Ivor Sickles, Surgeon and Diagnostician. Reverend Mr. Virgil McKnight, Chief Nurse. Private John Greenfield, Assistant Nurse. Date, May 5th, 1846. Admittees and new cases. A. 5:12 a.m. William Tucker, Private, Company E, 2nd Artillery. Powder burns on hands and face. Festering blisters, drained and bandaged by IS. Released. B. 5:25 a.m. Theophilus H. Holmes, Captain, 7th Infantry. Left leg swollen from 6+ shell splinters. Removed by J.P. Bled 6 ounces by I.S. Soaked and dressed by V.M. Given 15 tablespoons of Rupert's tonic for the pain. C. 5:55 a.m. Jason McDonald, Private, Company B, 7th Infantry. Second finger of right hand pierced by shell fragments. Amputated at second joint by J.P. Sewn and dressed by V.M. Given 15 teaspoons of Rupert's tonic and released. D. 6 a.m. Julius Caesar McCoy, Private, Company C, 7th Infantry. Fever and the shakes. Requested something for the pain. Given pint, Rupert's, and released. The six-sided frying pan of the fort sizzled, sighed, spat grease and smoke. Our tireless major ran across the ramparts, from our bomb-proof view, silhouetted by the purple sky. Down in that dark and dirty cave, Sarah hugged the red-eyed Mrs. Sewell, afflicted with nervous hysteria. Two lieutenants quarreled and their companies came to blows. The end of the fisticuffs was celebrated with a whipping. I crammed my face into the dugout wall. G. 6:10 a.m. Alfred Earl Bix, Private, Company D, 7th Infantry. Broken leg, left, from rolling round shot. Set by IS. Painkiller requested. Given 15 tablespoons, Rupert's. H. 7:30 a.m. Oliver DeWitt, Private, Company H, 7th Infantry. Contusions, examined by J.G. and released. I, 7:30 a.m. Buford Young, Private, Company H, 7th Infantry. Broken nose, set by V.M., released. J, 7:30 a.m. Paul F. Otis, Sergeant Major, Company H, 7th Infantry. Fractured rib, examined by J.G. and released. K, 7:35 a.m. Robert Trowell, Jr., Private, Company F, 7th Infantry. 2-inch laceration on left forearm. Stitched by I.S., 3 teaspoons Rupert's, and released. L, 7:35 a.m. Mrs. Captain George Washington Sewell, nervous hysteria and crying jags, comforted by Mrs. Private Jack Berginnis, volunteer. 30 teaspoons Rupert's and prayer, released. M, 7:40 a.m. Everett Higgleson, Private, Company F, 7th Infantry, broken blood vessel under right eye, lanced and drained by V.M., released. N, 7:10 a.m., Oliver DeWitt, Private, Company H, 7th Infantry. 10 lacerations along upper back. Correctional. Washed by V.M. 30 teaspoons Rupert's. Solve. O, 7:15 a.m. Julius Caesar McCoy, Private, Company C, 7th Infantry. Very minor contusions. Tripped and fell down. Requested something for the pain. Examined by J.G. Given pint Rupert's and released. Hardly had that fight ended when another threatened. The Southern boys watched with detached amusement as two Company B boys from Albany started an argument about the anti-rent war that had been going on for 7 years now and was still going on. All the New Englanders itched to spend their 2 cents of words on it, too. Cursing the silver button, silk cravat, swanky, gothic scrivened Van Nabobs. The boys were so mad about it that they almost came to blows. Seems that one of the boys said the Van Rensselaers should be shot and fed to the dogs, and another said no, they should be hung and fed to rats. Then one of the better groomed Southerns suggested that it was the ordained result of the Northern loose labor system. Most of the boys didn't care about the argument, but they were sorely irked by the challenge. Captain Mansfield was hammering one of the cracked supports back solid when he smelled another brawl coming. He asked PPFS to do something, something, to lift the spirits of the men. The moral surgeon seemed oddly plucky for some reason. During the night, he had somehow gotten his steam pressure up again. I saw him making his toilet, snorting hot steam to melt off the tar from yesterday afternoon's sport. After that abuse we had served him, the women gave him all the affection of their feminine charity. Sarah watched Mrs. Fredrickson touch up the scratches that the boys' tough frolic had made on the pink circles on PPFS's porcelain cheeks. With a bashful laugh, she took up the rouged brush herself and went to work dandying up the smudges left by the hot tar, although she had helped feather him, I recall. Mrs. Hampton and Mrs. Forrest led a Fort Texas Committee of Ladies for the Protection of American Strangers and the Promulgation of Hospitality, and reintroduced the metal man into our company. Neither lady made no mention of the unfortunate incident, but a warning was implicit by the sternness of their cheerfulness. The metal man ticked and hissed happily. I wondered where we found the fuel to get all his dander, boiler pressure, up. The moral surgeon puffed steam and pondered, ticking his Babbage calculating machine brain wheels. Tick, 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 tick. He ticked. The moral surgeon puffed steam and pondered, clicking his Babbage calculating machine brain wheels. I have 8 lectures, he ticked. Tick. Something patriotic. Number 7, The Devil in Daniel Shays, a ditty fit for drinking. Tick! His ever benign countenance moved nary a porcelain hair, as only his gray glowing grass eyes betrayed the warmth of the boiler furnace, building more steam pressure. And then, to our common amazement, the metal man began to sing. His tone resounded like a bell. His rhythm chimed most regularly, but there was a tremulous, boiler bubbly quality to his hiss-lisped vowels and a shrillness that showed his pressure too high for steam whistling in an enclosed space. The Devil and Daniel Shays. In 86, the devil come to Captain Daniel Shays, saying, "Daniel, you've set your last Union Jack ablaze. But when the banks have got your farms, how can you be free? When the Senate hears no prayer of the Sons of Liberty? The governor's caterwauling Tory rhetorics, but we learnt how to skin a cat in 76. Come farmers, come debtors, come poor men and all. Follow Daniel to the Springfield arsenal." With fire locks, the farmers made the big court run. In Concord, the devil talked up revolution. "To hell with the Senate. Justice ain't funny when nabobs strip you bare and there ain't no paper money. The governor's caterwauling Tory rhetorics, but we learnt how to skin a cat in 76. Come farmers, come debtors, come poor men and all. Follow Daniel to the Springfield arsenal." Bad luck stopped the Continentals of Luke Days. 1,000 men alone followed Captain Shays. No sooner was brave Daniel's "Charge 'em, boys," said, the Bay State Militia bombed 4 debtors dead. "Hold the line," cried Daniel. "But blood's been shed. Is Daniel worth dying for?" the devil said. "Your wives and wee ones weep for retreat. Patience, not Daniel, will rise out of defeat. 4 debtors dead, and 1,000 more surrendered. The senators thank the devil for his service rendered." Daniel Shays was jailed a year, forgotten ever after. But in his dreams the devil come and sang to him in laughter. "The governor's caterwauling Tory rhetorics, but we learnt how to skin a cat in 76. Come farmers, come debtors, come poor men and all. Follow Daniel to the Springfield arsenal." Before it was over, before it had even begun, in fact, the men picked up pebbles and pelted the most unpopular of metal men. The pebbles pinged and clanged and entertained the men a great deal. So I guess you could say that our moral surgeon accomplished Captain Mansfield's request. So the major's aide, lantern-jawed Lieutenant Fredrickson, found us in a good humor when he come down to the dark and dirty bomb-proof. He strode the gallery, holding up his hand for silence. When he got it, out of curiosity, he called for 20 volunteers to drag a big gun to the east side walls. It was dangerous business, the yard getting pounded and bowled by a hot 9-pound shot. "But the bombardment has a bit abated," he assured us, which meant the Lunars were moving their cannons again. There was no dearth of volunteers. Your average cotton baler never was one to shirk duties, not counting deserters. Maybe we were just bored, but we crawdads of Company C jumped up fast, right behind Kelly. "We must proceed with all due alacrity," called Fredrickson, ducking his tall frame as he led us up and out. Oddly, the metal man followed. R, 7:55 a.m. Hiram McMartin, Private, Company B, 7th Infantry. Wound of May the 3rd, become sorely infected. Bled 8 ounces by IS. Candidate for amputation on the morrow. Soporific applied. 1 1/2 pints Rupert's Salve. S, 8:10 a.m. Francis J. Patterson, Private, Company G, 7th Infantry. Excessive pediculosis. Scalp shaved by J.G. Note, otherwise unable to treat due to lack of kerosene. Released. T. 8:15 a.m. Stuart Stuckey, Corporal, Company A, 7th Infantry. Stomach poisoning and fever. From tinned food? Emetics. Took a quart of Rupert's tonic, given by Mrs. Private Jack Berginnis. U. 8:30 a.m. James Small, Private, Company E, 2nd Artillery. Burst eardrum. Bandaged by V.M. Offered Rupert's, but refused, citing pledge. Under the confusion of iron balls and bursting shells, through the acid clouds and electromagnetic thunder, we crawdads followed the major on the run, hauling at and kicking poor Martha Mule across the yard. The yard looked more like the moon than Texas, all churned, lumpsy-daisy, pocked with craters, sort of like army pudding. At the number two guns, Captain Loud was waiting. We leaned on the spokes of the wheels, and lightning cannon creaked down the slope, the iron rims cutting deep into the sand. The going was slower along the level yard, and Martha Mule was too terrified to cooperate. While I heaved on that heavy iron tube, the gunners running back and forth past me, from number two to number four and back again, I was so inspired as to think theologically. For instance, when a shot appeared in the sky, just a dot, fast growing larger, as we all hunched down flat against the carriage of the cannon, I got the feeling I should telegraph my apologies to my Creator for my doubt in His existence. It plunked down a few yards to the side, spitting hot sand in my face. As I stared at it, spinning lazily, I figured that was the Creator's way of morsing me. To Jack Berginnis, quit your sinning ways, stop. From your Creator, stop. End message. Well, as I sweated corporeally, driving my hobnails into the slope as we pressed, pushed, persuaded with our pain that the ordnance should roll upward, my soul sweated as well, if such is possible. Just as we reached the number four platform, I heard the horrible screech of a mortar shell plummeting down right on us. No, I thought in an electric flash, with the sentiment that I would not stop sinning until I received some divine punishment for past sins. The moral accounts were sorely in arrears. I felt the deity's credit under question, although not his awfulness. In fact, this old business of belief sorely bankrupt. Defying the worst, I cowardly covered my hands over my eyes. The shell swooshed and landed just outside the rampart with a thud. I wiped the splashed dirt from my face, dirt mixed with a tear or two of gratitude. Maybe the awful deity wasn't so awful after all, in which case I could miss, called the major, standing up. All right. Well done, Company C. Back into the bomb-proof with you. Captain Miles, if... Just then, Prince President Franklin Stove, who had followed us all the while with the unflinching bravery of clockwork automation, now suddenly ticked, and threw up his hands. That motion tipped him back awkwardly, and he toppled over, falling down the inner slope, coming to a stop at our feet. At the same time, the mortal shell rolled over the rampart, kicking sparks, following an old gutter cut by 9-pound ball. And it dropped into the platform, where I felt a fiery wind. My ears ached, but I didn't hear the detonation. It flung our commander down the slope. He slid down beside the metal man, his uniform in tatters. "The Major! The Major!" A mob formed around him as men left their posts. We turned him over slowly, shouting. He tried to smile to reassure us. He stood up shakily and pushed our hands away. He blinked and gestured at the abandoned posts. Red spots grew all over him. He stared at us. Frightened mice quivered in the cages of his eyes. We laid him in a wheelbarrow and wheeled him to the bombproof. AB, 8:40 a.m. Julius Caesar McCoy, Private, Company C, 7th Infantry. Dizziness. Requested something for the pain. Lecture by Mrs. Captain Dixon Miles on the evils of alcohol. Given pint Rupert's by Mrs. Private Jack Borganis upon promise not to return. Released. Addendum. Upon return of patient, 8:41 a.m., Mrs. Borganis removed patient from infirmary to give him reason to need the attentions of medicine. AC, 8:45 a.m., John O'Connell, Lieutenant, Company F, 7th Infantry, gout in left knee, old arrow wound. Soaked and wrapped by Mrs. Private Horace Jellison and Mrs. Lieutenant Simon Griswold, volunteers. Painkiller requested. 1/5 pint Rupert's and released. AD, 8:50 a.m., Jacob Brown, Major, 7th Infantry. 40-plus shell splinters located in face, neck, left arm, torso, left leg. 15 fragments removed by JP. Bled 16 ounces by IS. Further surgery and bleeding on the morrow. Bandaged by JP, IS, and VM. 2 teaspoons Rupert's in prayer, hourly. God have mercy. That's dirty cards, I prayed, down in the dark and dirty bombproof. I don't care to wager faith with no sneak thief. If that makes me evil, well, I'm sorry. You had your chance to punish a sinner, that being me, a murderer, but you chose a fine and virtuous man. You don't play fair now, do you? I'd be insane to sing hosannas to the miserable likes of you, liar. You're a fraud, a fake, a charlatan, a quack, a hypocrite. You ain't nice, you ain't cultivated, and you ain't even sensible. You are so insane. You cheat. Deal me out. You should be tarred and feathered and rode out of town on a rail. You're worse than a horse thief. You're savage. I pledge myself to sin and sin again. And I was mad, and we were all mad at the metal man. We felt he had a part in this bad business. Thank you for listening. Okay, a couple historical notes. Around the time of this war, in upstate New York, there was something known as the Anti-Rent War. All right, I'll read from Wikipedia. The Anti-Rent War, also known as the Helderberg War, was a tenants' revolt in upstate New York during the early 19th century, beginning with the death of Stephen Van Rensselaer in 1839. Van Rensselaer, who has been described as having proved a lenient and benevolent landowner, was the patroon of the region of the time. Van Rensselaer was a landowner with ancient feudal rights. Before the American Revolutionary War, the patroons acted as feudal lords with the right to make laws. The Anti-Rent War led to the creation of the Anti-Rent Party, which had a strong influence in New York state politics from 1846 to 1851. This is probably a sideshow to the main issues of Manifest Destiny. The Metal Man sings a song about the Shays Rebellion. That was earlier. Again, reading from Wikipedia. Shays Rebellion was an armed uprising that took place in central and western Massachusetts in 1786 and 1787. The rebellion was named after Daniel Shays, a veteran of the American Revolutionary War and one of the rebel leaders. It started on August 29th, 1786. Precipitated by several factors, financial difficulties brought about by a post-war economic depression, a credit squeeze caused by lack of hard currency, and fiscally harsh governmental policies instituted in 1785 to solve the state's debt problems. Protesters, including war veterans, shut down county courts in the later months of 1786 to stop the judicial hearings for tax and debt collection. The protesters became radicalized against the state government following the arrests of some of their leaders and began to organize an armed force. A militia raised as a private army defeated a rebel attempt to seize the federal Springfield Armory in late January 1787, killing 4 and wounding 20. The main rebel force was scattered on February 4th, 1787, after a surprise attack on their camp in Petersham, Massachusetts. Scattered resistance continued until June, with the single most significant action being an incident in Sheffield in late February, where 30 rebels were wounded, one mortally, in a skirmish with government troops. The rebellion took place in a political climate where reform of the country's governing document, the Articles of Confederation, was widely seen as necessary. The events of the rebellion, most of which occurred after the Philadelphia Convention had been called out, but before it began in May 1787, are widely seen to have affected the debates on the shape of the new government. The exact nature and consequence of the rebellion's influence on the content of the Constitution and the ratification debates continues to be a subject of historical discussion and debate. Some 4,000 people signed confessions acknowledging participation in the events of the rebellion in exchange for amnesty. Several hundred participants were eventually indicted on charges relating to rebellion. Most of these were pardoned under a general amnesty that only excluded a few ringleaders. 18 men, including Shays, were convicted and sentenced to death. Most of these were either overturned on appeal, pardoned, or had their sentences commuted. Two of the condemned men, John Bly and Charles Rose, were hanged on December 6, 1787. Shays was pardoned in 1788. And he returned to Massachusetts from hiding in the Vermont woods. He was, however, vilified by the Boston press, who painted him as an archetypal anarchist opposed to the government. Shays was later granted a pension by the federal government for the 5 years he served in the Continental Army without pay. Shays joined the local militia during the American Revolution, rising to the rank of captain in the 5th Massachusetts. He was involved in the Boston Campaign, fought at the Battle of Bunker Hill. He also fought at Lexington and Saratoga. He was wounded and resigned from the military, unpaid, in 1780. Upon returning home, he discovered he was summoned to court for unpaid debts, which he still could not pay because he was not paid for military service. In 1780, General Lafayette presented Shays with an ornamental sword. Shays later sold the sword for a few dollars to pay off his debts. After returning from the war, Shays was alarmed to discover that many of his fellow veterans and farmers were in the same financial situation as he. Commoners' meetings revealed that veterans were treated unfairly upon release, and businessmen were trying to squeeze money out of the smallholders in order to pay their own debts to European war investors. Many Massachusetts rural communities first tried to petition the legislature in Boston, but the legislature was dominated by Eastern merchant interests and did not respond substantively to these petitions. The petitions or proposals often included a request to issue paper currency. Such inflationary issues would depreciate the currency, making it possible to meet obligations made at high values with lower valued paper. So I think the anti-rent war was in the tradition of Shays' Rebellion and other anti-rent uprisings in North America. I don't think they directly have to do with Manifest Destiny, but the young American mob democratic spirit could unleash these types of forces. The enthusiastic mob spirit of democracy of young America the soldiers would carry these issues and feelings with them. I think James Fenimore Cooper wrote a novel about the rent wars. Okay, thanks again for listening. Please pick up Moonifest Destiny by Peter Gilman on Kindle for 99 cents.